My word. A panel game devised by Tony Shrine and Edward J. Mason. Dillis Powell and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden in a game about words, with Jack Longland in the chair.
We go straight into the first round, which is about words, and this week about various isms. And for 2 marks, I want to know what the meaning is of these isms. And Frank Muir begins. Chauvinism. C-H-A-U-V-I-N-I-S-M. Chauvinism.
There's no vinism. Like chauvinism. Chauvinism means a blinkered, irrational, overzealous patriotism.
Absolutely right, yeah.
I think there was a citizen, Chauvin, who thought that Napoleon and his wars were the best thing since French bread.
Absolutely. He was a veteran of Napoleon's, and he figures in a book by a chap called Cognard, which I think translated means the tricoloured cockade, and he was exactly as Frank Muir has described him. 2 marks. Anne Scott James, Micawberism.
Well, it means really extreme optimism. Mr. Micawber, very irrational optimism. Being, as we know, a character in Dickens, who was always in debt.
Yes.
I'm just like Mrs. Micawber, really, because she was a very miserable, optimistic. Very unnecessarily optimistic wife who's always leading her into trouble. This has rather been my husband, I mean, this has rather been my fate through life.
Well, I hasten to reassure our audiences all over the world that Anne Scott James doesn't look in the least like Mrs. McCormick. Very, very, very much better looking. So, 2 marks. Dennis Norden, yours is Momism. M-O-M, hyphen if you like it, I-S-M.
Well, I suppose the earliest example would be Oedipus.
Yes.
It's a kind of exaggerated respect for mother, which although I think we tend to associate it with America, we would do well to remember that there is a certain popular mass-produced bread which rather plays on this feeling as well.
We mustn't mention it. No, absolutely right. It does come from perhaps mawkish adoration of one's mum and probably passively accepting her domination over you. 2 marks. Dennis Powell, hedonism.
Hedonism means the pursuit of something which is generally forbidden by political parties. Pleasure.
Well, listen, I was afraid you were about to say armed rebellion. But you're dead right. It's that doctrine. I suppose it comes into the theory of ethics, in which pleasure is the highest good, you think, and the proper end of any action you may intend to do. 2 marks. Before we go on to the next round, here are the quotations for the last round of all. And Frank, yours is, hello, hello, who's your lady friend?
And your...
Is that right? And yours, Dennis, genius is an infinite capacity for taking pains. And so to round two, a round of origins and derivations, and again for 2 marks, how did the following words or phrases originate, or from what did they derive? Frank Muir, and please, it's not meant personally, a fig for you, sir.
It's a bit filthy, Jack.
Well, you can take it on less filthy than not side. It can be
well,
done.
Well, how can you when it's filthy? It's an expression, you insert the thumb between the two fingers.
That's right, yeah.
In a gesture of derision or
that's
contempt
right.
Or something. Yeah. And it's very continental. And therefore, by definition, filthy.
to all brackets, absolutely right. Yes, in French it was called faire la figue, but as I think Carol Brahms said on one occasion, everything's all right if it's Shakespeare. And Shakespeare uses this in Othello, in King Henry IV, and The Merry Wives, a contemptuous gesture to somebody whom you don't think very much of. A fig for you, 2 marks. Anne Scott James, the origin of a question mark.
All you're going to sort of tell me, put it to me.
The origin would be a question.
That's fair enough. But now the sign that we use...
Actually, the shape of it.
The sign that we use in printing, which is a question mark.
Oh, I see. The actual punctuation shape.
And you've got to take it back right to Latin, I think.
It's an ear and an eardrop.
It looks like that.
Oh, well, I was just going to say it was a musical... Left, gone sort of upside down. But if it's Latin,
now... Think of the Latin for question.
Questiona.
Yes, questiona. You've got that, questiona.
Oh, it's like a Q, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. Yes, that's right.
It doesn't look
mine
as a Q at all.
It doesn't to me either. But you're right. I mean, this is a 1.5. The original printer's sign, so I'm told, or maybe the original manuscript sign, perhaps before printing, was Q over O, which is an abbreviation of the Latin questio, which means question.
Oh, yes.
Dennis Norden. A square, in the modern sense of a middle-aged outsider, traditionalist, and so on.
Well, it's a funny word, actually, isn't it? Because
yes.
It's done a complete turnabout of meaning. Do you remember that song... Her name is Mary, Mary. Remember?
Yeah.
Because it says it.
Because
there is something there that sounds so square. It's a grand order, meaning it sounds so right.
It was originally honest, straightforward.
I would think that would be the derivation of it, because if you take square as meaning four square,
yeah,
standing for all the kind of old values, I think this word came about roughly when people, or young people, started rejecting the old values, therefore four square took on a derogatory meaning.
I give you 1.5 again, because I believe there may be several origins to this phrase. It did originally mean honest or straightforward, particularly among the criminal classes, curious enough, and they got somebody who went straight. But according to Eric Partridge, it's a jazz musician's steady 1-2-3-4 rhythm without any variations or syncopations, a rather pedestrian measure, and if you think of his hand beating the time, it makes a square.
I bet it could come from a square head equally.
It might do that. It might even come from square dancing, I think. Old-fashioned music of that kind. Anyway, 1.5. Dillis Bowers is, I think, more precise. A stickler over trifles.
Well, it's somebody who sticks.
You might have a stick.
If
you remember, Romeo, when Mercutio was fighting Tybalt,
yes,
he tried to stop the fight,
yes,
and it was unlucky because Tybalt's sword went through and hit Mercutio.
He got stickled himself.
Yes, so what was Romeo trying to do? He was
trying to stickle them. He was trying to stop them and break off the fight.
Yeah.
And
losing the fight.
I'm going to give you 1 out of 2. The stickler was the umpire in originally a tournament, a jousting tournament, or in a duel, a man who thought very carefully about etiquette if the chap was making the wrong pass. And therefore he became an umpire or mediator. And it means to interpose between the combatants. And he's a referee. Well, now we come to a much easier for me, do-it-yourself round, in which each member of the team is invited to coin a word to enrich our already sort of fairly rich language with a word of their own invention or manufacture which they find they've got a pretty urgent need for. 2 marks if it really makes any sense at all. And now I'd like to know the word and what you say you think it means. Thank you.
There are so many unusual and beautiful and interesting, and splendid words. I don't want to add to them, but I think that if I can quote from my children, when they were very young, had a couple of terribly good words. One was for that stuff, white stuff you put on roast beef, which they called horse rubbish. And one, which is a perfect description of one of those weatherproofs, which are sort of tweedy, and keep the water out, but retain it themselves, which they called a Mekin sop. I think the one I'd like to see used isn't so much a new word as a re-stressing of syllables in an existing one. There's a splendid old actor called Eric Chitty who wrote to me that he thought I'd be interested that his grandson had produced this. And it's a new reading of a word to describe somebody who's got up in the morning looking rather sort of worn and creased about the face and everywhere else, which his grandson called bed-raggled. I think that should be added to the language.
Well, I resist the temptation to give you six marks. And I shall give you a bonus, and I shall make it three. But there's horse rubbish, Mekin sop, and bed raggled. Seem to me some very good neologisms. Anne Scott James, your turn.
I badly feel in need of a word to describe people of the age of my husband and myself. Now, we don't very much like being called the old folk, with its sort of connotation of touching the forelock and carrying soup to the cottages. We don't like being called pensioners because we never seem to have never yet received a penny in any description of that direction. We particularly dislike being called senior citizens. One of those awful bureaucratic euphemisms which really make one faint. I think when you reach our age, what you really are is some nice and mature and ripe. And as nobody's allowed to be called a man or a woman anymore, I think there should be a word called a right person. Who are over 60 or over 65 in case of man or whatever it is. So put right person into the dictionary.
Yes. Rightness is all.
Right person we accept straight away.
Oh, incidentally, I was thinking of something else. I said to my husband the other day, really, you cannot talk about the upper classes anymore. And he said, no, but you can call them the Chateau Bottle.
Yes, we have that one.
Again, I'm bound to add a bonus. So three out of two. Now, Dennis Norden.
Well, my first thought wasn't a word, actually. It was occasioned by coming here. That what we need is a new hand signal for motorists, particularly me, going the highway code, and it simply means, I'm sorry. You know the cases when you turn, put your hand up to turn right and decide, no, I won't, I'll go straight on after. You want to do something to indicate to the man behind that you know you've made a mistake and don't get all uptight. You know? And that led me to the word eureka, which we use, I found it. There should be another word, equally Greek and expressive, for I blew it. I did it wrong. And I think all these foreign words we import should have opposites. Like, for all the people who have charisma, there's at least 10 more who have charisma.
Well, I accept charisma with enormous gratitude. I think it goes on at Camelot or somewhere. Two marks straight away. Phyllis Powell, your turn.
Well, you see, whenever I think of a word which would suit me, I find it already exists. It's very tiresome. I wanted a word for invective and abuse to address to people who get in front of me in the queue for the potatoes. And I thought, you squinch. And I find it means an architectural support. So that doesn't really help me. But my sort of quiet life involves a good deal of standing in bus queues while going to look for the queue for the potatoes. A Dutch friend of mine used to insist that in the Dutch cavalry, the word for command to mount was "Skoop de beestes." Well, I feel, you see, that the word for what is so quietly named a bus queue, which is not a queue at all, is a mad massacre, should be a squabble.
Again, a bonus mark for that beautiful scrabble up to beasties, which I don't think one can possibly be. And we come to the last round, and Frank and Dennis's quotations, with the marks to be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. And Frank, if you remember, your quotation is, "Hello, hello, and who's your lady friend?" And I'm so ancient that I remember the next line, which is, "Who's the little girlie by your side?" Anyway, we'll let Frank loose on this. It's a musical
Hello, hello. Had not the organist in our village said that line to me, we would never have seen probably the most triumphant production of the Thorpe Players. And we had Mr. Haddock, the church organist, was and orchestra, he was playing the harmonium, you see. And we were going to do the Boyfriend by Sandy Wilson, but it's got rather a lot of girls in the cast. And the Thorpe Players is remarkable in having almost no girls. This is partly due to the fact that we have an influx of playful, rather sturdy lads who've come to work on the new motorway. And when they arrived, most of the girls left. So I thought if I twisted the Boyfriend and made it the Girlfriend, or made it, actually I called it the Lady Friend, because it's rather classier, because we are in Surrey. And I had the story of these boys from the grammar school at Strood, who are school leaving age, and the boys go to London on some kind of social project, and they're in a hostel with a lot of girls, and they sort of all fall in love, and it all went swimmingly, and then we had this inexplicable tragedy. In the middle of the night, it was a Thursday, just before opening on the Saturday, the right-hand side of the harmonium keys disappeared overnight. It was awful. It was a frightful sight. Really, it was. It was like a grin of somebody who's had the right-hand load of teeth pulled out. Just nothing. It was just a sort of bass, couple of bass octaves left. What could have happened? And what we were going to do to open on the Saturday. Desperate. So I went round the village, and I went to our sub-postmistress. And I said, "We're in trouble. I'm terribly in trouble for Saturday night. How low can you get?" And the response was terribly disappointing. And we went round all the village, trying all the ladies out for a low, because she's got to be able to sing this song. This lady, the lady friend. I could be happy with it. And we were in despair. And Mr. Haddock and I were walking round the corner of, do you know Lime Lane and Thorpe? But all the diggings, you know, around there, the allotments. And there's one superb allotment kept there by Hugh Scanlon. Scanlon's an old Thorpe name. And he was this tall, cadaverous ex-grave digger, you see, with this curious face and this very deep voice. And we suddenly saw that all the rows of lettuces and sprouts and whatnot all had these shiny markers in the end. And Mr. Haddock said, "They're my harmonium keys." And he said, "Where did you get those?" He said, "I found them in the village hall. Took them from an old disused harmonium." push the wooden bit in the ground, and you can write begonia on the ivory. Look. I thought, well, he's ruined. And suddenly Mr. Haddock said, wait a minute, talk again. He said, what do you want me to talk about? Mr. Haddock turned to me and said, quick, find a wig, an outsized dress, and high-heeled strapped shoes, size gents number 11. So I said, what are you talking about? He said, didn't you hear his voice? It's the solution to our problems. So I said, what are you trying to tell me? And he said, we found a low, a low. Hughes, your lady friend.
Life is nothing if not eventful in Thorpe. And we go on to Dennis Norden, and his quotation was, genius is an infinite capacity for taking pains. Thomas Carlyle and possibly several others thought about this. Dennis.
Well, assuming it to be Thomas Carlyle, if not the several others, although that line is always offered as the definitive description of genius, it's not a description that I've ever accepted. In fact, I'd go as far as to say that genius, whenever I've come across it, has always revealed itself as an infinite capacity for not having to take pains. But my main quarrel with the quotation is that it only works providing you modify it or in some way amend it according to the kind of person you're applying it to. Let me explain. Take Jack Longland's territory, education. Those educationalists who advocate higher grants for university students, what their genius requires is an infinite capacity for staking brains, while those who have so successfully opposed corporal punishment, well, obviously they were gifted with an infinite capacity for breaking canes. And now, when you turn to the wider world of trade and commerce, well, you can find an abundance of examples that of the fact that genius goes beyond merely taking pains. I mean, those multinational food corporations whose breakfast cereals now adorn every kitchen table in the Western world, what they clearly possess is an infinite capacity for flaking grains, while the technological genius who's filled our world with foaming detergent was quite obviously born with an infinite capacity for caking drain. You say you find the same need for rephrasing the quotation, even when you consider the humbler, more sort of idiosyncratic areas of business enterprise. That country blacksmith who successfully revived the ancient art of manufacturing arrows for weathercocks. Would he have succeeded without an infinite capacity for making veins? While over in Denmark, the small factory owner who managed to capture the entire national market for alarm clocks, would you deny him an infinite capacity for waking Danes? Even more pertinently, would the shareholders' reports of any of these enterprises have presented so rosy a picture if their accountant had not been blessed with an infinite capacity for faking gains? You could even extend this to this rewording to the activities of that young lady doctor in the Midlands who set herself up as what she calls a surrogate wife. In other words, rendering very practical assistance to all those young men who are worried about their sexual adequacy. how could you define her genius but an infinite capacity for quaking swains? Well, that list just about exhausts my personal pantheon of geniuses, with, of course, one very obvious exception, my distinguished colleague on the opposition bench. So I put it to you, now that you have heard his way with a narrative about an amateur dramatic society, does Thomas Carlyle's quotation come anywhere near describing Frank's ineffable gift? Of course it doesn't. With Frank Muir, there is need for one more turn of the screw. Genius is an infinite capacity for talking puns.
Well, I think that's accommodated everybody from Shakespeare to Einstein. And by your vote, ladies and gentlemen, Dennis Norden, in fact, wins the story. But over the contest as a whole, the result is quite remarkable. It is a draw.
Taking part in My Word were Anne Scott James, Dillis Powell, Dennis Norden and Frank Muir. The chairman was Jack Lockhart. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the program was produced by Tony Schreiner.